Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Managing Today's Challenging Behavioral Health Inpatient Treatment Demands Conference Call. My name is Jim and I will be your operator today. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. We will be facilitating a question and answer session towards the end of the conference. If at any time during the call you require assistance, please press star followed by zero and an operator will be happy to assist you. I would like to turn the presentation over to your host for today's call, Ms. Kathleen McCann, Director of Clinical and Regulatory Affairs for the National Association of Psychiatric Health Systems. Please proceed, ma'am.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you to our participants for joining us on our teleconference today. We're very happy to have two faculty members who are nationally recognized leaders in our field. They have dedicated much of their professional careers to understanding and meeting the needs of persons who are receiving treatment in psychiatric inpatient settings. You will realize soon that they both approach their work with passion, creativity, and great wisdom. The agenda for our call will consist of two presentations, followed by a question and answer session. So I advise you to be jotting down your questions as we go through the presentations. There are three PowerPoint presentations listed on the NAPHS website, which is www.naphs.org, and they can be found under the link to the teleconference, which is at the top of the left column of the homepage. Hopefully you've had the opportunity to download the presentations before the call or that you are viewing them on your computer now. There are also a number of pertinent resources posted at that site. Our presenters may refer to them as they speak, but the resources are mainly for your reference after the call. Our first speaker today is Dr. Kathleen Delaney. Kathleen is Professor of Nursing, Department of Community and Mental Health Nursing at Rush College of Nursing in Chicago, Illinois. During her career at Rush, Dr. Delaney's clinical interest has been creating safe and healing environments for children with serious emotional disorders. She has been particularly interested in proactive approaches that prevent the use of coercive methods, such as manual restraints, during inpatient treatment. Kathleen has been active in the work of both the American Psychiatric Nurses Association and the Association for Child and Adolescent Nurses in developing guidelines for restraint seclusion and standards for inpatient child and adolescent treatment. She has built a is piloting a neurobiological model for a proactive approach to reducing aggression. Over the past 10 years, Kathleen has also been involved in crafting a graduate program in psychiatric mental health nursing that is centered on the neurobiology of illness and evidence-based treatments. Kathy has been on the boards of several psychiatric mental health nursing organizations and is currently president of the International Society of Psychiatric Mental Health Nurses. Kathy, I'd like to turn the program over to you and your PowerPoint presentation, which is titled Fill in the Blanks, guys.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks so much, Kathy, for that nice introduction. I appreciate it. I wish I could see the faces of the participants. I'm sure I know some of you and have met you all. Thank you for joining us. The title of my presentation today is Calming the Milieu, Reducing Stress via Creativity and Connection. And by the end of the presentation, I think you'll understand what I'm talking about when I say that a proactive approach to me involves being able to connect with patients and also being creative in how you do that. And if you can accomplish that, you'll actually reduce the stress level of the milieu and have a calmer milieu. So I'm going to weave our way through those ideas today. I want to thank you for allowing me to come into your offices. 2 hours is a lifetime for frontline staff. I've been one for many, many years, and it's also for managers. So I'm thank you again for taking time out of your day. Kathleen asked me to talk about the practical ways to address the dilemmas we face, particularly in building safe and healing milieus. I think that's really what the core of what psychiatric nursing staff does, is constructing environments that are safe for everyone so patients and might heal. And when I say heal, I mean from the exacerbation of their illness and the havoc it's wreaked on their sense of control and choice. Often I talk about the elements of building safe milieus in terms of what I call a 4S model of how nurses build safety, structure, support, and self-management into their everyday practice. But today I want to talk about that the milieu from a bit different slant. I want to really talk about the relationship of stress and a calmer milieu. I want to talk, I have on that, on PowerPoint number 3, the stress framework, just as a reminder, classic definition of stress when demands exceed resources. So what kind of demands are, of course, the patients are under, and what kind of demands are nurses under? I have a list on slide number 4, and the first begins with well-known factors of our current inpatient nurse environments. They're hectic. Often there's competing demands on nursing staff. I'm honored, really, to go to about 2 or 3 hospital systems a year, either for giving a talk or as a consultant. And when I go to those systems, I hear about the number of hours nurses are taking in paperwork alone. That often in some systems where one nurse is responsible for all the orders and all the medications and much of the paperwork, and so feel so stretched. And then leaving the rest of the nursing staff, and when I say nursing staff, I mean mental health workers, mental health counselors, leaving the rest of the nursing staff out there with also stretched to meet all the demands of patients. But the demands of our work, I think there's some more internal pressures that those of us that work know well, and I'd like to just say them out loud. One is the administrative pressures to keep beds full. When I go to units, of course, there's expectations about census. Right now in Illinois, our child units around the city are full. Partially that's because our outpatient services under budget constraints are collapsing, but irregardless, there's this idea that people should be keeping beds full because there's so many patients coming our way. When I go to some states, I find that hospitals are under pressures to find a bed for any client, that admission to your unit includes any patient that comes to the ER, be they forensic clients that are transferring over from the jail system, or be it very ill clients that belong in a medical unit, but for whatever reason, end up on a psych unit. We find that the mix of the types of patients on units has created a new demand on inpatient staff. We see shortened length of stays, which everyone knows about, but the hidden pressure in that, which the staff can tell you, is that discharges and admissions start coming rapidly. A friend that runs a state system in New York told me that she doesn't really use acuity measures that much, that she really just uses the amount of discharges and admissions, because an admission can take anywhere from 2 hours of concentrated time. A discharge can take an hour of meandering time as you pull together the elements of the discharge and find holes and the ability to get medications or transportation home, and all of a sudden those time pressures start building. Once you have that situation of many, many admissions and discharges in one day or 1 week, you have a fluctuating acuity. This creates a particular demand on staff, because what looks good at 1:45 when you're just about setting evening staffing, well, all of a sudden you have 3 intake calls and your staffing level no longer looks good at 3:30. And of course, if you have inflexible staffing patterns and you can't adjust the number of people to keep the unit safe, there's another demand. All of these are what we all in inpatient units live with almost every day. On the next slide, you'll see Kathleen asked me to make some particular mention of child units throughout the talk, and I will. So I want to talk about that on a child unit, we have some added dimensions that cause stress and tension. Just as adult inpatient children are only admitted to an inpatient unit when they're dangerous to self or others, which is how it should be. And so we have very ill children, and they're populated with children with disruptive behavior disorders, anxiety, post-traumatic stress, bipolar, autistic spectrum. Research tells us that these are children whose illnesses are marked by affect dysregulation. So they are children that are prone to release strong affects via tantrums, venting, sometimes aggression. For them, it's what Nancy Eisenberg calls behavioral coping, not emotion-focused coping where we try to directly dampen down the emotion, or problem-focused coping where we try to think or plan or problem-solve around the situation that's causing an emotion, but rather these children blow off these strong emotions by what we consider to be, perhaps we think of it as boiling over, perhaps we see it as meltdown, whatever. It's in the view of, again, Eisenberg et al., that these, you're really seeing inadequate ability to deal with strong emotion at that point. So I like to think about children and treatment of children in terms of self-regulation theory. And on 6, I have a very simple definition of self-regulation theory of how one part of the brain system governs the reaction of another. In a sense, we really have to sustain coordination of our thinking and our emotions when emotions boil over and negative emotions continue unchecked. We start not being able anymore to think through them. Our mind begins to shut down. Now, all of you out there have experienced strong emotions, and you might do a couple of things. Let's just say my husband won't like this, but when I get one of my many traffic tickets, you know, and you're so upset, and when you get stopped, and, you know, you're kind of frustrated at yourself. And so the first thing you do is, you know, you might try to not control your emotion, emotional suppression. We're able actually to dampen down strong emotions. Research tells us that when they hook up brains to people's brains in research magnetic resonance machines, and they give them challenging tasks, they first evoke emotion, and then they ask the person to shut down their emotion and go back working on a task at hand. We can see that the parts of the brain that charge up during emotion can actually be dampened down, something we call emotional suppression. We know that disturbed children have sometimes particular problems with emotional suppression. They're less efficient at it. So are depressed adults. It takes much more energy for them to suppress sadness. Another very key element of our brain when we're dealing with strong emotions is attention control. We can shift our attention away from the stimulus that's causing us to be disturbed. Think of how many times you say at 9:30 at night, okay, that's just enough. I'm not going to be thinking about that anymore. I'm done with it. And you can kind of shut your mind away from the stressor and shift your attention onto something more pleasant. This ability to shift our attention away from threat or a negative emotion is really key to our regulation. Finally, on my list there of building blocks of self-regulation, we have response flexibility. And that is really our ability to respond to breaches of the unexpected, when something happens that we're not expecting, how we can adjust our coping mechanisms and use flexible coping mechanisms. So this is, response flexibility is an interesting area, and it's a cognitive skill that we find children with bipolar disorder have particular difficulty with. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. Now, self-regulation, then, we're really looking at some basic abilities we have to dampen down and keep emotions in check so our brain can keep thinking. so that we can keep thinking through the situation at hand and reach a goal. Now, with children, if we turn to page 7, we can see that on any given unit, the internal dynamics and patient factors can start combusting. And every inpatient person out there knows that all of a sudden the noise and pace and movement level of the unit gets to be an uncomfortable level. Inpatient staff, especially seasoned staff, have an intuitive sense for how a particular part of the day feels. For instance, right before a meal, we know that the pace of the unit picks up. There's a lot of movement. You can feel it in the air. Fridays at 2 o'clock, that you can feel the pace of the movement, the pace of the meal you're cooking. But it doesn't sustain itself. There's kind of fluxes in the activity level and the noise level. And so it's very important that nurses actually have these tangible skills of keeping the noise and pace of a milieu at an acceptable range. And this is on page 8. A long time ago, I actually wrote an article about these tangible skills that novice nurses need to understand how to rein back in the noise and pace of a milieu. I've listed 3 of them there. Keeping an outward calm is when the milieu pace quickens, it's very important that you as a staff slow down. Using space on a children's unit to create a sense of calm, splitting up groups, positioning children in the group, intentional seating. These are kind of embedded staff knowledge about what to do on a child unit when you feel the tension level is rising. How to take track of your resources using all available resources. The number of staff you have, knowing who your particularly talented staff are, knowing what staff are good with particular patients. You're starting to call in this kind of sense of what are my resources and how can I use them. If anyone would like that article to give to your newer staff, I certainly can send it to you. I talk about it as a level of skill development because experienced nurses, this becomes embedded clinical knowledge for them. They do it almost quite naturally. I also wanted to do it to talk about those kind of skills to illustrate the difference between top-down and bottom-up strategies. Because for the rest of today, I'm not going to talk about skill building to keep a milieu calm. I'm going to talk about bottom-up strategies. On slide number 10, I'm sorry, you'll see some top-down solutions that we use to help people keep milieu safe. Technical skills, ones I just talked about, technical skills at de-escalation, safe handling during an aggressive incident. These are technical skills we now train staff in, very important. Team skills that we try to engender and as our group of staff learn to work together. In the new restraint and seclusion era, we understand the key importance of organizational support as a top-down solution. Organizational support at every level of the organization. But there's also bottom-up solutions, I think, that are very, very important. And you'll see 3 of them listed on slide 10. And I'm going to talk about each one of them. Unit philosophy, a sense of staff purpose, and an effective unit structure. I'm in no way dismissing the top-down solutions, but I think it's a story of which side of the elephant you're on, if you allow me that kind of image. I go to many presentations every time I'm at a conference and there's an inpatient presentation, I go, and I hear really people moving ahead with restraint and seclusion, moving ahead towards new models where they use technical mastery and training and organizational support. I also go to units, and I'm called into units where the training hasn't worked so well, where the hospital has brought in various training schools, and still they get a sense that their units are operating with coercive rules and that their physical holds are high. And in those type of units, it's pretty clear to me that these kind of bottom-up strategies aren't in place, and so the the training is kind of washing out because they haven't built the platform that every unit needs to really have a calm and safe unit. The other reason, if you turn to slide 11, the other reason I really want to talk about these bottom-up strategies is because our goal shouldn't really be, our goal should be proactive interventions in the milieu into emotional turmoil, tension, anxiety, negative emotions. We're starting to see this idea of proactive milieus in sanctuary literature, in person-centered literature, and in my model where we're trying to reduce coping demands. This is all proactively to create a milieu where actually don't have aggression bubbling up because you have intervened early. So my basic premise is that a real way to achieve a safe milieu is connecting with patients, building this platform in connection with their narrative of their illness and recovery, with families, with their perception, in my case, of the child's needs. With children, we build a connection that we're useful adults in their lives, that we help them regulate so they can experience well-being and social inclusion and self-esteem. So on page 12, you'll see, again, these three platforms that I'm going to talk about: positive appreciation, staff sense of purpose and personal control, and creation of effective structure. In each case, I don't want it just to be a philosophical talk, so I'm going to talk about the tangible ways I think you can start as a unit to either examine if they're there for you or to start building them in a more concrete way if they're not. On page 13, slide 13, you'll see that the three platforms are really drawn from Len Bauer's inpatient model. On that slide, I have an article by Len and his model of how to reduce conflict and containment on acute psychiatric wards. Excellent article. And Len talks about some of the conditions that have to be in place. And his first one is indeed this positive appreciation of clients. It has two components in Len's model. First is a psychiatric philosophy, how staff see the nature of mental illness and their role as a nurse. So what is the psychiatric philosophy that your unit holds to for how people improve and recover and heal on your unit? How well understood is it? And the other part of a positive appreciation is the moral commitment to clients. What is the stance of your staff of being non-judgmental, of humanism, sense of people's rights? On our unit, our motto is that we want children to have the experience of being respected, responded to, and understood. And we try to live it as best we can because it's our philosophy. It's what we hold to in our everydayness with children. Now, what are some tools on 14? I worked with units that want to just start this process, and we work together. I start with a leadership team on the unit, usually the frontline staff, the unit manager, and then the frontline staff, the unit manager feels are invested in this process, and they together start the first draft of a philosophy of the unit, how patients should be treated on this unit. They weave in a sense of how you expect patients to heal and regain a sense of control. I always add children. I also think for children, afford them a sense of mastery because you want them to be successful in the environment. And also for adolescents, you want them to develop a sense of their involving narrative and the narrative that they're starting to build as young adults. I'm sure this is very small font, and I apologize. The unit where I've been associated with for 20 years now is called Fort Kellogg, and this is the philosophy of treatment that Fort Kellogg built many years ago and still holds to. We've added a few things. I just put it as an illustration. I think that you can see in the first three statements are really about how we expect children to be treated, I especially like children only act for as much as they need, which goes along with the children should be responded to because what they're presenting you with is what they need. And then if, for example, on statement number four, and I'll read it, it's more about how we expect the milieu to boost functioning. So children vary in their ability to process information, sort stimuli, and manage emotions. By experiencing the child's ability to meet milieu expectations, staff determine the amount of structure and of clarity a child needs to function. So this is our sense of what we need to do in the environment to help a child succeed. And we do many, many different things. I'm going to try to think of a concrete example. For instance, if a child has trouble with transitions between groups, we might have staff sit right next to that child during the group. We might bring the child in the middle of a group. We might have the child leave if they have trouble at the end. We might have them leave a little bit early. Again, we try to do whatever a child needs to help them succeed. So, on the next page, is some patient-centered care guiding principles. These are, again, just examples, I think, of unit philosophies that should be a deep keel these days of how you're actually going to treat the people that come to you for safety and healing. You have to make it your own as a unit, I think. The very conversation of staff to bring their ideas together is in itself growth-producing. Again, in Len Bauer's model, it becomes one of the cornerstones of reducing conflict and building a sense of connection with patients. I just want one last point is after you put it together, you have to make sure you're doing some of the things that you say are important to you. So, for instance, if you build a philosophy of treatment on a child unit that the family is important and you still only have 2 hours of visiting for the family, then your structure is not matching your philosophy, and you have to start thinking about how you're going to open up your visiting and so on. If you have a patient-centered care principle that said that the patient is the source of control of their care, then you have to look at what is in your structure to operationalize that principle. Otherwise, these become just posters on the wall. I would like to talk about the second foundation now of connection, and that is the staff sense of purpose and control. I think in some sense, restraint and seclusion for frontline staff, at least in some of the units, have had unintended consequences where staff behavior and sometimes when staff is unsuccessful becomes the foci for all criticism that gets brought on a unit. In Len Bowers, when he did studies of units, he found that staff will have a focus on risk reduction that are in a system with a lot of floating staff, high patient turnover, significant amounts of violence, that their focus is on risk reduction and violence management. And so when you ask staff in that kind of predicament to change, you have to realize, and if you have a pen, I love this quote, that change requires creativity, willingness to take risks, and curiosity. So if you have a staff that's in protective defensiveness, just trying to feel themselves for the next criticism of their practice, it's going to be a constraint to curiosity about the nature of practice. So we need to think about what we can do before we start asking staff to be curious about treatment, to be creative about treatment. On page 18, we need to have a sense that staff has a sense of purpose of their job and a sense of control over their own practice. What are some of the tangible ways that I've worked with other units to build this? First of all, support, and that really means from your frontline manager, support in terms of making sure that staff have the tools, the space, the time they need to deliver care. This comes from the trauma literature that there needs to be democratization on the unit. And democratization on the unit isn't just with the patients. It has to start with the staff. They have to have some control in decision-making. Finally, staff need to have some sort of empowerment that they have some control over their practice and they have some choice. This is what the patient needs. This is what the patient seems to be telling me he or she needs. How much creativity and risk-taking do I have? Slide 19, what are some of the vehicles for creating staff decisional control or democratization? Really, regular meetings where issues are aired and staff has a voice in reaching solutions. As I mentioned, frontline managers that understand the purpose of staff work and advocate for the space and the time and the staffing. I often go to units where the nursing station is at one end, long hallway, day room at the other, and I talk about that this is such a bad space, you're going to have to be creative if you're going to be available to patients, and it's really the frontline managers that are going to have to advocate for creative use of that space. And again, building a philosophy that includes patient and staff's voice and decisions. All of these will give us our first component of this platform. We want to build a staff sense of purpose of their job, that their job is meaningful. Again, on just a simple line for you to remember that from the sanctuary literature, disempowered nurses cannot create environments where patients are empowered. So you can create environments where psychiatric nurses practice psychiatric nursing, meaning connecting with patients, if you've got a staff that has no sense of decisional control or no control over their practice. On page 21, I talk about the second half of this platform, personal control. I think this has been not looked at enough lately, that for you to have an environment where you stay connected with patients, we have to think about staff's control of their own emotional responses. How much can staff stay non-reactive in stress? On page 21, here's some of the things that I talked to when I went about this element to staff. How much space is there between your action and your conditioned response? So a milieu situation is in front of you, perhaps someone, for us, a teenager refuses to go to a group. Your conditioned response is to be like, wow, you know, what is your conditioned response? And we need a little space there. You know, I always, I teach my students that my favorite intervention is, I'm going to say it, is, I love that intervention, just saying, huh. So a staff, you know, a teenager goes to me, I'm not doing that. I always say, because it gives me space. You know, it gives me space to think. It gives me space to not respond. It's just something that I teach my students is one of the most valuable things I do in psychiatry. Because that little space helps me find that internal delay button where you can refocus on what's really going on here. What does this patient need right now? What's this behavior telling me about what the patient needs? I went to a presentation at the American Academy of Child Psychiatry where a psychiatrist has signs all over his unit, his adolescent unit, stay in your frontal lobe. So he says in an emotionally charged situation, I try to say to staff, the child's going to their limbic system, their amygdala, you stay in your thinking lobe. So whatever you can do on your unit, we need to have staff that have a sense of personal control over their own reactions. Slide 22, for adults, what does controlling your own emotional, why is it so crucial for connection? Remember, this is calmness and safety via connection, because it's only when you can control your own emotional behavior that you can be mindful. I have a little explanation of what mindful means. And it's really having intention to your action. You purposely choose your behavior with the idea of your patient's well-being. I believe that's only then when you can begin to grasp the patient's narrative of illness and also have that emotional right brain to right brain where you actually feel your way into the person's emotional experience. Automatic responses, we start negating that. I have some stories, but I'm already starting to run out of time about mindful behavior, but I can't – tell you it's one of the more intriguing concepts for me about intentional presence with patients and getting back to what psychiatric nurses and psychiatric nursing staff should do. Because on page 23, only when we really are mindful can we start responding to patients' expectations, their worries, their hopes, and grasping the patient's narrative of illness and recovery. I'd like to just say real briefly, this one, I have on my notes that I want to tell Stella's story of sleep, and so I'm going to stop for a minute. And I did a research study on patients' perceptions of illness and recovery, and I was talking to this woman interviewing her for the study, and she said, sleep is just the most important thing. Sleep, 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 sleep. No one understands sleep. And she kept talking, and I'm like, what's with sleep? You know, I said, the nurses don't understand why sleep's so important. So I finally said, how are you going to get better? And of course, she said, when I start sleeping. And she started explaining to me how she gauged her relief of depression according to her sleep, and how she had this kind of idea that she had to get to sleep by 10 and sleep till 2 and then take a pill and go to the bathroom and sleep from 2:10 to 6:10, and that meant she was getting better, and how she gauged her own sense of regaining control over her depression by her sleep. Once I listened to how she reconnected all these stories for me, I understood how terribly important indeed sleep was. Now we know it is. Sleep is important on a physiological level. So the patient's narrative of why they became ill, what's going to help them recover at every level, we have to take some time. We have to be there with intentional presence. And that's one of the keys to connecting with patients. On slide 24, for children, why is space between action and response even more critical? It's a key element of connection for three reasons. And again, this is in an article that's in press. It's on the bottom there. So if I'm starting to talk fast, you can read about it in an article that's coming out soon. But with children, we have to have empathic attunement with affects, and that takes space and concentration. Children have sometimes poor emotional language, poor store of emotional language to label their affects. They maybe haven't had practice at emotion, cognition, connection. They're lacking these basic skills of affect tolerance so they can think about their affects. You as staff have to be that bridge, and you have to do attunement. You have to create that kind of emotional socialization, that connection to what's happening to them and explain it to them. You have to maintain a positive tone to interactions. The space helps you with that. Why is positive tone? We know from the literature that a positive emotions alone will dampen down stress. And that in the article I talk about the latest neurobiological research that will tell us that you process information better when your brain has a positive emotion going. It will actually boost your working memory. And finally, we have to monitor for threatening tone at all times on child units. There's nothing that will stop a child's information processing quicker than threat. We know for children with a history of maltreatment, for children with anxiety, that once threat enters in, their perceptual field narrows. So very quickly, we'll talk about the final platform, and that is how staff uses space and constructs interactions in the structure of their day. Staff constantly have to be looking, what is the effective structure of our unit? Is it enough to help folks feel organized but not invaded, to have some predictability? But is there some choice for people? Do I have rationale for any kind of norms or expectations? Have I told the kids or have I told patients these rationales? Many units I go to, staff will affirm limits are needed for control. Actually, the reverse is true with children. Consistency, yes, but any firmness that wavers into threat, you're actually you're causing patients to be alarmed and they'll have less efficient information. How staff implements these unit rules on page 26 and the expectation impacts upon how creative they can be. You'll see on the next slide that research has demonstrated, and when I talk about this, I'm mainly talking about the research of Alexander, that limit setting around rules is often viewed by nurses by patients as nurses just simply exerting their control. And we also know that rule enforcement often precedes incidents of violence. So the actual stance of people, staff around rules, is terribly important. But the flip side of that is the staff's sense that they can be creative in their practice. So I'm going to just talk for 1 second about 28. And it's on the left side, what I think that being creative means, I've already talked about, increased what happens to a child's information processing with increased threat perception, what happens when children have poor response flexibility, meaning they cannot respond to changing conditions. When you say group is over, the child kind of has a meltdown because they were concentrating so long on their project, they lost track of time. All of these things actually exacerbate reactive aggression. So if you, on the right side, can actually keep expectations in line with the child's ability to process, if you know the child's reaction to the unexpected, if you understand that structure has to be mixed with tolerance every day, then you can start taking a sense of you can start really enacting flexible rule setting. On 29, and this is my next to last slide, I quote some research that myself and Mary Johnson did, and there's the article where we watched a staff who used very little restraints on a highly acute unit. We sat and watched them for 9 months and isolated the skills they used. And we find that they were really marked by this positiveness and creativity and a kind of generosity of spirit, risk-taking in how they intervened with patients, and how much a sense, because they had a sense of control over practice, they felt they could take risks. I'm going a little over, so I will just say, on 30, summing up, that my own research demonstrates that nurses have distinct sets that keep patients safe. And they are flexible in our last article of being flexible in their approach. But this takes creativity. And creativity in nursing only really comes when you're armed with control over your practice. You have to have those platforms of both personal control and control over practice. And then you can move into patient-centered care. Moving into patient-centered care, we need to be aware when rules are trumping needs. And for children with regulation difficulties, that you can reduce instances of reactive aggression, emotional meltdown, by reducing stress. And on the last page is a model that is in the article that's in press. It'll be in the Journal of Child and Psychiatric Nursing this autumn. And this is the diagram, which I quickly touched on these boxes of what I believe are critical staff behaviors for keeping demands on a unit, for first of all developing a milieu marked by attunement with children's needs, and then what are key staff behaviors for reducing threat, decreasing frustrations, and appropriately setting expectations. And I believe that neurobiology supports that these type of behaviors on staff will actually lower stress, lower demands on children, and you'll actually get lower reactive aggression, and you'll have less need for de-escalation techniques. And that's it, Kathleen. I hope I'm 2 minutes over.
You're just fine on time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks.
Listen, thank you so much for that very thoughtful and insightful presentation. I'm sure that it will serve as a basis for some very productive ongoing discussions on the on our participants' individual units, and I would really highlight for people the references that are contained in your slides. Your articles are just so very pertinent, and I think people would find them to be very, very helpful. And we look forward to continuing to chat with you on our question and answer session.
Sure.
Our second presenter is Gail Blueberg. Gail heads the newly formed Office of Technical Assistance Center for Peer Networking for the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. I refer to often as NASHFID. She has been involved in consumer advocacy for almost 40 years and has worked in many different capacities. She is a core faculty member of the Center for the Prevention of Violence and trauma, and seclusion restraint reduction, and has done multiple on-site and off-site projects of a technical assistance. In 2006, she produced and edited a film titled Leaving the Door Open, Alternatives to Seclusion and Restraint, which will be released by NASHFID in the near future. And she recently completed a technical report and guidebook entitled Paving New Ground, Peers Working in Inpatient Settings, and an accompanying DVD, A Dialogue with Peers and Family Members. And these are available on the NASHFID website, and we've also posted them on the NAPHS website. I would really recommend those highly. Gail has been involved in the consumer, survivor, ex-patient movement since it began in the 1970s. She has always combined her background as a registered nurse with her work in advocacy. Gail has received many awards for her work both nationally and locally, most recently the Exceptional People Impacting Community Award from the Broward County, Florida, for her work in Broward County, Florida. We're really privileged to have Gail with us this afternoon and look forward to her presentation. Thank you, Gail.
Thank you, Kathleen, and thank you, everybody, for joining. I wish I could see all of your faces because I'm not sure if that's easier to see your faces or less easy. But at any rate, I'm glad that you're with us, and hopefully I'll bring to you some information that you may know something about and would like to know more. A little bit about my PowerPoint. Hopefully all of you are open to it, which is called Peer Roles in Inpatient Settings, a Core Strategy. For those of you that know anything about our curriculum to reduce seclusion and restraint through NASHFID, we have a number of core strategies or modules in which we do training, the peer roles being one of the core strategies. Others are things like neurobiological, myths of mental illness, leadership development, prevention tools, and others. So some of you might have gone to trainings that we've done regionally and in different states. So actually, my work also comes out of that initiative to reduce seclusion and restraint. I may not refer to it too much directly in this PowerPoint because I'm going to be talking mostly about the types of roles that can be developed in inpatient settings, but it does very much relate to a strategy to reduce seclusion and restraint. At the opening slide, I'm going to first give you a couple of definitions that I think may be helpful. The word consumer, probably you're all familiar with that word. The definition is a person that is currently or has formally received mental health services, either voluntarily or involuntarily. The word consumer is sometimes used broadly to include individuals who prefer to call themselves survivors, ex-patients, clients, users, or many other similar terms. Sometimes people will combine consumer, survivor, ex-patient, and when they use the word survivor, they're often implying their survival of the mental health system and not their mental health diagnosis. The other word, again, that you'll hear is peer, which is another term for consumer, but is often accompanied by a word that implies the provision of supportive services or activities with other consumers and peers. Peer support is a system of giving and receiving help founded on key principles of respect, shared responsibility, and mutual agreement on what is considered helpful. Frequently, persons who provide peer support receive training to become peer specialists. In order to become a peer specialist, one must self-identify as one who has received psychiatric services. So that just gives you a little bit of background and some definitions that we'll be working with. So on slide 2, one of the things that I do, probably more than some of the other peers who also do trainings is to acknowledge, recognize, and honor the very early grassroots at which the persons early in the 70s were engaged in what we called a liberation movement. And at that time, abuses in the system were very prominent. People were being used as slave labor. There was deaths occurring that were not being investigated, and seclusion and restraint, cheating, other practices were being used that were very hurtful and harmful to people. So it was out of this movement, out of this period of time when people felt like they had been abused, that they began to come together and form organizations. One of the first organizations was in California, a group called the Network Against Psychiatric Assault, that put out a newsletter called Madness Network News, with the byline of all that fits that's news to print, if you can hear that. This newsletter was published for over 10 years and was probably responsible for bringing people together from all different parts of the country who were organizing. Again, they called themselves ex-patients rather than, you know, the word consumer was not yet in vogue. In the 1980s, the federal government began to take notice of these activities and sponsored the first alternatives conference in Baltimore in 1985. And at that time, people came together with many different perspectives, people that agreed with the medical model, diagnosis and treatment, and others who did not. And it was at that time that they came up by consensus with the term consumer that would embrace all of their concerns. I think if you talk to many consumers and have had that opportunity, you find that many people still don't like the term, but they haven't come up with anything better. So that seems to be the one that we're currently using more often. And then in the 80s and late in the 80s and close to the 90s, 2000, was the beginning also of demonstration projects for what was called drop-in centers or consumer-operated programs. Okay, in slide 3, again in 1990s, there was the beginning of research projects and the beginning of talking about recovery. So I'll stop there. I've been asked to talk a little bit about recovery, which is not going to be my major theme, but recovery sort of permeates all of what I will be talking about. There are many definitions of recovery. I'm going to give you one, which has been used by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, which is, and I think it was written by Bill Anthony, journey of healing and transformation enabling a person with a mental illness to live a meaningful life in the community of his or her choice while striving to achieve his or her potential. Like I said, there's many definitions. Pat Deegan has done extensive writing on recovery, and you can go to her website, Pat, D-E-E-G-A-N. You're probably familiar with her work, and so that would be one place where you can find out more about it, as well as the website for the National Empowerment Center and some of the works of Dan Fisher. Since 2000, peer roles have become more accepted and integrated in all areas of mental health. Okay, we'll go to the next slide. In 1999, the report of the Surgeon General's report recognized that self-help as an important adjunct to traditional mental health services and concluded that self-help activities serve as powerful agents for change in service programs and policy. During the early years in the 1990s and 80s, the word self-help was used really that now we use the term peer support, I think, to define the same kind of approach of people helping each other. So you'll hear more about peer support
than you will the term self-help. In slide number 6, the peer-run support services, the most common example is drop-in centers, holds promise for improved outcomes for a public health, mental health system that A, is underfunded, and B, fails to reach the majority of those with mental illnesses. This was concluded at a national experts meeting that was sponsored by NASHBID, the agency I worked for, which concluded that peer-run services were a promising approach, programs for the future. And, of course, now there are many drop-in centers. Actually, drop-in centers are being replaced by wellness centers that are being run by consumers in communities. So there are several. One of them is in Georgia and is functioning very well as a wellness and alternative healing center. Other types of self-help or peer support services include support groups, crisis respite, and other types of services, of which we'll talk more about. Okay, in slide 7, this slide really refers to integrating consumer choices at every opportunity, and by that we mean people that are receiving services or patients. We try not to use the word patient in terms of trying to give people more empowerment. So we'll use the word consumer or persons receiving services, or just referring to people as people. So people receiving services can have meaningful input into all aspects of their service system, including serving on decision-making committees where policies are developed and in assuring environmental and physical design changes. Persons receiving services have a lot of ideas and concerns about what is helpful to them. The question then can be asked is, what do people want? Even with children, we have done a lot of focus groups with children and adolescents in residential facilities, and when you ask the questions about what they think is helpful, frequently it's not the groups that they're going to or the support groups, but things like arts and different types of alternatives that they would like to pursue other than what is currently being offered. So I think the word choice is a very important word, providing the ability for persons to choose what types of services they want, involving them in program design, involving them in developing policy. There are now some facilities that actually involve or include consumers, patients, in hiring staff and hiring administrators. So you'll see a lot of involvement. This is not the peers yet who are working in facilities, but these are the people that you are serving. Hopefully you're, engaging in some of that, and the key thing there is to listen to people, do focus groups, find out what their interests are, what their concerns are, and what types of programs they would choose. In slide number 8, peers can serve as role models, communicators, mediators, advocates, teachers, and legal protectors. Peers provide support from a perspective of experiential rather than professional authority. Experiential knowledge is the type of knowledge that comes from firsthand experiences. Consumers frequently have special knowledge about the types of services they have received, what their experiences have been like, resources in communities, they can help people to anticipate what their experience is going to be like and offer important feedback to mental health provider organizations. First-hand experiences are often very personal, intuitive, and innate. Okay. Slide number 9.
self-help, peer support, and self-advocacy are being recognized as components of wellness, recovery, and even treatment. And that was written by two researchers, Martha Hodge and Curtis. I can't think of her first name all of a sudden. Laurie Curtis. That was in 1995 that was written. They were two kind of forerunners that supported the ability for people to recover and recovery initiatives. Peers understand the need for reform and often have the initiative to begin the task of creating new approaches to CARES. Persons in recovery hired as staff at all levels promote movement towards organizational cultural shift. One of the areas is in terms of peers, because they've been involved, because they've been provided services, they often know what it is, to where to start, and how to begin initiatives to begin creating new approaches to care. Peers who work alongside professional staff make recovery real through their own individual stories. Again, I'd like to say something about, what's important about recovery is listening to people's stories. And you can go to a variety of websites and find recovery stories. Almost all of the mental health organizations, agencies, whether it's Mental Health America, whether it's SAMHSA, you will find that there are narratives, autobiographies, biographies, stories that people have written that are helpful to other peers and also for staff to understand consumer perspectives. So I think that's one of the most valuable tools that we have. We also have videos that have been done that share people's stories and insights, and I think that probably you're taking advantage of those, and I can make a list of some of the places that you can find more of those stories. Okay, and number 10, firsthand experiences dealing with psychiatric disabilities equip peers with extensive practical knowledge and information in a way professional training cannot. Again, this issue of practical knowledge, how to respond to people, what is helpful to people. Peers have often developed a unique set of practical skills while they've navigated the system and their communities. They will know where community services are, where the drop-in centers are. Frequently when people are discharged, because I go to a lot of different hospital settings and do site reviews, I frequently find that there's no information for where people can go to when they go back into the community. And often the information about where the peer-run services are not made available because people just don't know that they are actually in the community. So these would be things that you can think about as services you can provide. Where things like free food and clothes might be found. These are all the types of information that peers would have, as well as information about rights and how to negotiate some of those rights. So I'll go on to the next slide. Delivering services differently. Peers may have greater tolerance for unusual behaviors and are less hampered by the need for professional distance. That was written by Sally Clay, one of our key consumer leaders and writers. She wrote a book called On Our Own Together, which developed the types of aspects or the components that go into developing a peer-run service. This particular statement, I think, is really important because when consumers are interacting with other people, they're frequently not seeing the same, they're not seeing them in the same way that that staff might. They might look at things more in terms of what a person's life experiences have been, whether or not there's been trauma in their life. They may be able to relate to them in such a way that they can communicate their own understanding and ability to, I don't want to use the word tolerate, but to accept people for the types of experiences they have and their behaviors as a result. Pat Deegan, who I've already mentioned, has written articles about hallucinations. There's been some work on that, some research, and whether or not hallucinations have a basis in reality. Peers can often think of their hallucinations as extensions of their experience and acknowledge them positively as part of their recovery. I think Pat Deegan spoke about her own experiences having had hallucinations in her own history. Okay, peer roles, core values build on trusting relationships, founded in a philosophy of empowerment and recovery. Self-disclosure is central, and peer roles based on mutual self-help. The value of self-disclosure is very key to the development of peer roles. This is an interesting phenomenon because more and more people that are professional are beginning to self-disclose their own histories. I now have several examples of people who are working as nurses or psychologists that have felt, because of, you know, how far we've come with this, with developing peer roles, they're feeling more free to open up and self-disclose their histories of having received treatment or their histories of mental illness. Years ago in Broward County, we actually created an initiative that all of the facilities, all of the private and public facilities, would hire consumers. That goes back to 1995, I believe. And we had one facility that came back and said, well, we do have a lot of consumers on our staff. They just don't choose to talk about it. And so we gave them feedback that indicated that that really was not the definition of a peer or somebody that would fill a peer role. On slide 13 is the definitions for peer principle and helper principle. Peer principle emphasizes the equality and reciprocity that should exist within the peer relationship, with both peers learning from each other. So it's an equal relationship in which one peer is not in control or supervising or has some sort of edge on the other person. The helper principle suggests that working for the recovery of others facilitates one's own recovery. I think that's something that we can all find in whatever role that we are in, whether it be a professional staff or a peer role, that we, you know, and when we're helping other people, we're also helping ourselves in our own recovery. Many peers are receiving peer specialist training. The beginning of this training started in Georgia, I believe, with a training that continues and began to have coverage from Medicaid. The peer specialist became Medicaid billable in Georgia through a special rehab option. I know that other states are working to allow for Medicaid coverage. In Florida, this is something that we are just about ready to have available to us. Arizona, which originally was called META, now Recovery Innovations is their name, is another large major training program. So when peers get training, they then receive certification of following testing, similar to, you know, other types of professional certifications. And this is helpful then for people that are going to, for facilities that are going to hire them. Not all peers at the same time, not all states even have the training available, but it is becoming more and more common. And GBSA, which is the Bipolar Support Organization in Illinois, in Chicago, is largely responsible for creating training programs. Okay, and slide 15 consumer roles in inpatient settings, there does need to be a lot of thought given to how this is going to be done. The hospitals need to be able to refine their organizational structures and practices to accommodate peer providers. Staff, one of the worst things that happen is staff not being prepared, not being trained, not understanding what the role of the peer is when they're hired. So there should really be a lot of preparation put into place with staff in order to prepare them, support mechanisms. The other thing that is important, at least in what I think is the most successful positions, is when first a peer person, a peer position is created at an executive level, because it's at that level that a person can function in a variety of ways, including helping develop policies. In slide 16, I won't devote too much time, for there has not been a lot of research done on these roles. There are some related research projects that have been done, or studies that have shown the value of case management when peers are on teams, and that when peers were involved in emergency rooms, fewer people were hospitalized. It's become quite common for peers to be present and for roles to be developed in emergency rooms for a peer to provide peer support during the long waiting periods. And there are several hospitals in the country that are doing that now. One of the first roles that was developed was the peer advocate role, which is basically an advocacy position. One in which the role involves complaint resolution, attending treatment meetings, protecting patients' rights, administering or being involved in consumer satisfaction, and serving as eyes and ears for the facility. This position is one that I had at South Florida State Hospital a number of years ago, and it's quite common in many hospitals that peers, as well as other people, non-peers, hold these positions. In slide number 19, peer specialists are now being, there's other titles being given to them, recovery support specialists, peer mentors, consumer liaisons, peer bridgers, and titles sometimes specific to the types of roles that they're in. Some of the things that they do are they participate in treatment team meetings, they facilitate peer support groups, provide individual supports, and they help with policies and procedures, serve as a member of the clinical team, assist with discharge transition, and provide training to staff and patients or service recipients. And slide 21, it's important when these roles are developed that there be a job description, but there be flexibility in the development of that job description so that peers are free to explore areas of which they have expertise or interest. There may be a newsletter that is produced in a facility which a peer may take an interest in or take over the development of. Creative and artistic projects, environmental enhancements, creating comfort rooms. This is another area that I frequently do training on, is developing comfort rooms instead of seclusion rooms. They're not really a replacement of seclusion rooms, but they're a room where people can first go to relax, to de-stress, or just really to have some alone time. Pet therapy, journaling and writing groups, and alternative healing and wellness programs. Now when you go into many hospitals, you'll find that there will be all kinds of new approaches, things like drumming, yoga, Tai Chi classes. These are all very popular things that peers and patients really enjoy doing and are now being considered part of treatment options. Cindy Mayhew she's not now, she's working in the community, but she was a recovery support specialist at Alton State Hospital, Alton Mental Health Center in Illinois. And she, her quote is, "What I am interested in is empowering people by just doing, like getting someone to stand up and tell their story. I want to see the patients in valued roles so that they can first feel good about themselves and thus be more invested in their own wellness." The next slide, number 25. One of the unique positions or roles is drop-in centers that have been developed in conjunction with hospital facilities, sometimes on the grounds of a facility or sometimes independently connected to a hospital facility. So they're a place for independent socialization, for people to really just hang out, not have rules so much governed over them. They're always a popular place. One of the things that I find is that whenever there's a drop-in center available to people, there's rarely an incident because people do get to do what they want to do, to be able to share with their peers, and the supervision is with other peers, consumer advocates that are hired to work in them. Elisa Smuckler was and is still, she's been in her position for a number of years as a drop-in center. She says, "For as long as I've been here since 2002, there have been no safety incidents. We have 100 to 150 people who come here every day who claim it as their favorite place. They play pool, watch TV, hang out with their peers, and have choices about what they want to do." Okay. Another interesting position, this has been developed, started in the state of New York. Other states are adapting these roles, is a peer bridger role, is somebody that works with people prior to discharge and then works with them in their homes after discharge. This would possibly be a role that could be provided for people that have been in private facilities because it does provide the types of support that people need to stay in their communities and provides linkages to community-based services and natural supports. So they are called a peer bridger, the bridging of hospital to community. They also teach skills so that people will be able to live successfully in the community, things like helping them write a check, how to navigate public transportation, and where the library is, where they can access other community programs. Okay. The next slide also reflects the position of the peer bridger. Marty Cohen in slide 26 states, "People served by a bridger are often able to develop more trusting relationships. The difference between me and them is that I have power. I can come in to help mediate." Now we're beginning, even as the peer roles that developed a few years ago are beginning to branch off into specialties. One of the positions that was created was in Massachusetts at Worcester and Tewksbury Hospital, where a peer became, her title is client liaison, or in quotes, debriefer. And there's kind of an interesting story to that. She went to one of our NETI trainings, one of the trainings that we did at NASHBID, and saw the information about debriefing and thought that there was an actual position for a debriefer, of which there never has been, and I don't think there are any other positions. But she went back and suggested to her administrator that they create a position for a consumer, for herself, to focus primarily on debriefing people after they had been in crisis situations or following seclusion and restraint episodes. She's been in this position for several years. She serves as a full member of the clinical team. She also works now a great deal preventively with persons who are at risk for crises, and works with patients proactively on their treatment plans. She reports to the executive administrator. She has a key role, and one of the things that she always emphasizes is the fact that she is one team member. She works cooperatively with other team members. On slide 27, there's a little more information about that. And that's also another important point about these roles that are developed, is that people cannot come into a hospital setting and think they're going to suddenly rework, revise, revolutionize, change, or advocate for very radical types of changes. They have to see themselves as working in a team and on a team. And so I think the most successful people that have filled these positions understand that, and are successful of being a full, active and responsive person on a team. Okay. Denise Cahotas, she is the person that is in this position. Her quote is, "In some cases, peers may be the most able to reach someone, particularly if they approach them with their own history of seclusion and restraint, their history of trauma, or their own vulnerabilities as a person who experiences symptoms from their own psychiatric disability." The other type of role for peers or for consumers is as volunteers. People from the community can come in and do self-help groups, such as Schizophrenic Anonymous, Double Trouble in Recovery, substance abuse type programs. RAP, some of you may be familiar with Mary Ellen Copeland, who is in Vermont and developed what is called a Wellness Recovery Action Program. She has written a number of books, videos, tools. You can do a search for just even with her name, and you'll come up with the types of trainings that she has offered. So many facilities or many people are being trained to do RAP groups, and come into hospital facilities to run these groups. There's even a few examples of people that have been in inpatient facilities who have gotten trained and then train other people how to do the recovery action plans. NAMI peer-to-peer training is common in many states. And community and statewide consumer organizations. In Florida, for example, we have a statewide organization called the Florida Peer Network that sometimes engages in activities that relate to hospital inpatients. Okay. Other specialized areas are trauma peer specialists, positions that are created for peers that work specifically with other peers that have self-abusive behaviors or issues around trauma. Another is expanding the debriefing role. Arts and creativity. I actually do a lot around the arts, and so I'm beginning to do some training on how the arts, and not art therapy so much, but how creativity can be included programmatically into hospital settings. This includes things like prominently displaying patient artwork in lobbies and hallways. That is becoming a very common thing when you go into hospital lobbies. You'll see people's artwork. Crisis prevention and intervention, emergency room peer specialists, which I mentioned. And I think that we're hopeful that in the future we'll have people that will serve as personal attendants in people's homes as alternatives to hospitalization. I see that I'm nearing the end of my time. Some of the barriers to peer roles is hiring only one peer, funding issues, staff not being prepared, inadequate support. There always has to be the built into these positions is support that they're going to need to through the staff or the person that they're reporting to or through a support group of other professionals to support them. Boundary issues is definitely an issue that needs to be looked at. A job description not clear. And burnout, of course, we know about that as staff, and but particularly peers will think that they can do it all and they'll work long extra hours and weekends, and that tends to be a problem. The last couple of slides, the hope, the word hope, I think is very important as part of recovery. The hope instilled in people recovering from mental illnesses through the dynamic exchange of peer support has the potential to foster hope and change for the mental health system. And finally, hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. A poem by, or a phrase by, Emily Dickinson. So I thank you very much. I would have liked to have said a little more about recovery. One thing I will say is I think that's a separate training. There is a brochure available through SAMHSA, and I'll make sure that you all have that website that talks about the 10 fundamental components of recovery. I'll try to run through them just really fast so I can get, you know, still within my time. Self-direction, individualized and person-centered, empowerment, holistic, non-linear, which refers to a step-by-step process, people having setbacks but not necessarily, you know, going back to their original place. Strengths-based, peer support, respect, and responsibility. Each of those have definitions, and there's lots and lots of writing and materials and articles that have been written on the subject of recovery. So I thank you very much, and I hope that this has been helpful to you.
Yeah, thank you. You truly are just such a national expert in leading the effort to develop the varieties of peer support services that have contributed so much to positive outcomes for the people we serve. And I think as providers in the non-public sector, we have so much to hear and learn about in terms of peer support and so many ways that we can develop access to that whole movement for our patients. And I wanted to take a couple of minutes to see if either of our presenters want to respond to each other's presentation, and then we will move on to a question and answer period.
This is Kathy. I'll give Gail a minute to catch her breath. You know, Gail, I guess before your presentation, I didn't understand the whole scope of what the peer system entailed. I thought of it as a very singular thing, and I'm so glad to hear of all the different facets of it, really. But I think I'm... One of the things that I'm sitting here thinking so much about is on slide 32 of that we don't think of what we're doing as how we can, well, I think we do think of it as how we can help people rediscover hope or help people rekindle hope. But your idea that this dynamic change of peer support, that could be the kindling of hope, which in turn could be the real lever of change for the mental health system. That's a very intriguing idea. I'm going to have to think more about it. I think there's even some separate writings. Jean Campbell, who is a prominent researcher on consumer issues, talks a lot about hope. And in fact, I think she was serving on a joint commission committee where she tried to inject the aspect of hope. And in terms of even having that be part of central to the reviews that they're doing, the Joint Commission. I'm not sure if she ever was able to get that actualized, but I do think there's been a lot of movement in the direction of recognizing that whole aspect of hope. that, in, you know, and I guess I just want to say one thing about this long kind of thing that I've done that's focused on peer support is that, finally when we put it all together, we're really all bringing ideas together. I think that was a line that you said, Kathy, and that we're really able to work together, and as it evolves, with people learning from each other, we're then eventually we're sort of on the same page, working together towards the same goals with each group learning from each other.
Absolutely. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. And I know, Dale, I'm talking with you in other venues. You have such powerful stories of how this really has been operationalized and really is working so well. And I think sometimes, you know, it takes a little bit of time and patience and commitment to believe and to have that hope that this is something that can work effectively in many, many, many different settings. And I, I have been so impressed by your own stories of the power of this, of the peer support movement.
Well, one of the questions I would like to throw out is whether on the phone, with the participants, whether any of the facilities have, the private facilities have begun to hire peers. I don't think that it's totally unique. I think that there are some that have done this successfully, and the only thing I don't have a report on is where these facilities are, but every once in a while I do hear from facilities that are wanting to do this, or I'll hear that it in fact is happening not just in the public sector but in the private. So if there's anybody that can speak to that, I'd certainly be interested to know that.
Great, and I encourage people to make that part of the question and answer session. And operator, I think we're ready now to open the lines for questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star followed by 1 on your touchtone phone. If you wish to withdraw your question, press star followed by 2. Questions will be taken in the order received. There will be a brief pause as the questions queue up. To begin, please press star 1 now. First question we have is from Elizabeth Andrus from Bethes Hospital. Please proceed.
Good afternoon. This is Elizabeth Andrus. We're from Baptist Hospital in Pensacola. And there was a request if any listeners were participating in peer specialist program, and we do. We have one full-time peer specialist on staff, probably had her for a year and a half now, and it's working very, very well. We just hired our second one that's in orientation now. Her role in the inpatient world has primarily been with the adults. She's very, very involved in every aspect of our program, our treatment planning, gets very involved in meeting with every client, is a wonderful resource to myself, helps, she works with our physicians in giving reports from our, to support the patients in giving information to the physicians, does groups on the RAP, just taking a lot of initiative in developing our program.
Well, I'm certainly excited to hear that, and especially that it's in Pensacola. I would imagine that that Clint Rayner is somebody that you know about also. Is that right?
Yes, we do.
Uh-huh, yeah. Because he actually was one of the forerunners in Pensacola who held a position at a hospital there.
Yes.
But anyway, that's very exciting. It's just really, really wonderful to hear that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
The next question is from the line of Linda Sinosa of New York Presbyterian Hospital. Please proceed. Linda Sinosa, your line is open.
Pat?
Yes. Linda?
Pat, please.
Oh, Pat. Okay, thank you. Next question, operator. Operator, I think we should move on to the next question. I think they're passing.
Please press star followed by one if you wish to ask a question. There are no further questions at this time. Oh, yes, we do have one just came in from Sherry Keeley of Legion Health. Please proceed.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. This is actually Deb Spalding from Legion Health, and I just wanted to share a little bit about our peer specialist program as well. We are a system of care that has inpatient, partial, outpatient, and residential treatment center. And we have around 8 peer specialists throughout our continuum. And they are trained, most of them are trained in the RAP program, so that is one of the basic things they do as far as scheduled groups. But we've just really had a really positive experience with our peer specialists. And one of the stories that's really kind of cool is that we had a patient that was being transferred from partial program and needing to have an inpatient stay, and our peer specialist was actually on duty that day and actually walked with the patient and was able to transition that patient from partial to inpatient in a very positive light that, you know, really shared that she had been there before and I'll go with you, I know it's scary, and that was kind of the interaction that the two of them had, and we had a really positive feedback from that patient that really made a difference in her life. So we've had, and we've probably had peer specialists over the past maybe 2 to 3 years. And so just wanted to share that it really does work, and we are really encouraged by our peer specialists.
Well, the other thing we've done is we have advisory council that our peers serve on, and we recently opened an acute, a 64-bed acute facility, and as we were designing it, that advisory council came through the facility, helped us pick out the colors and just how it would be designed, so it's been very helpful. I am interested in, I was intrigued that you're using peer specialists in a debriefing. Do you have any examples you could talk about?
We one of the things I didn't mention was that we have a monthly conference call for, it really started out for networking peers that are working in inpatient to be a support and kind of training for them. What we're finding is that more and more providers are also joining this call. And our last call, which was in May, we do them the third Wednesday of every month, was with Denise, the person that I spoke about doing this position, and her, we actually had a combination, Denise and Tony Riccitelli, the administrator, talking, the minutes of which may already be on our NASPID peer networking site, but I also intend to do a summary of that call, because we're finding the minutes are just too long for people to read. The other thing that's on there is information about the job description that was developed for that position, the types of questions that she asked, kind of the template of questions that that she asked as a debriefer. Anyway, there's some very related and specific materials that can be used and would be very helpful in developing similar positions. What we're finding is that a lot of hospitals are sort of adapting that and using peers that are also in other roles, that they're using them to occasionally or to also use them in that debriefing role. So you might have a position based on that, or you may have that as part of a position that does other types of there's other kinds of activities, I guess is what I'll say. So I hope that's helpful, but it is on the peer networking site. Let me just give you that information for everybody. It's www.nasbit, and I'll spell that out because I never can remember myself. NASM is Mary, PhD.org/consumernetworking.csm. And you can find those materials as well as other materials related to these peer principles.
Thank you. One other question that I have, one of the challenges that we've really been kind of thinking through is how to get, in our RTC program, how to get parents involved that may have had kids in our programs or even parents of children and adolescents that have had, you know, kids in treatment. What kind of advice could you give us in regards to getting some involvement on the non-adult side of our work?
Well, good question. I actually don't have the answer, but we have people that are working more in the children's facilities. One of them is Beth Caldwell, who is a consultant to NASBIT and lives in Massachusetts.
We know Beth very well. That's
what okay, because, I know that she's done some work in that area as well as Janice LaBelle. I think her expertise is in the children's side. So there's probably a lot of work being done on that, but I just am not well versed in telling you where and exactly what's happening. But either Beth or Janice would either know this information or be able to direct you to somebody who would.
Thank you very much.
I think too with a lot of the parent support groups that are very strong are really internet based too. Not necessarily parent groups that would come together for peer support, but parents that support each other, like the Bipolar Kid Organization, and it's the one that comes right off, and of course, CHAD. Parents seem to get together on the internet very well.
Oh, that's a great, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I will say one other thing, though, is that in Florida, for example, we have peers being trained as peer specialists, and they're going to be developing a curriculum for family members to become family, I'm not sure what the title will be, family specialists, or, you know, they obviously won't be a peer specialist, but it will be along the same lines. And I'm not sure exactly when that will get started. I don't know if there's other places in the country that are training them or not, but there's definitely in the works a plan to do that in Florida. I also wanted to just ask real quickly where you were from, the Legion. I don't know how you spell that. But
Omaha,
where?
Nebraska.
Oh, in Nebraska.
In Omaha.
Well, I hate to just take up the time. Maybe we could talk later, but there's a conference that's coming up, our annual alternatives conference. Do you know that?
Okay.
Why don't you contact me later, because this is happening in Omaha in October. It's definitely something that you would want your peers to be involved in. And I'm sure you're going to be hearing about it, but I'd be glad to give you that information, too.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
With a question from Carrie Cowlock of River Edge Hospital. Please proceed.
Hi, this is actually Raul Almazar. Just to add to what Gail was saying in terms of the question earlier on family-centered care, there's a residential facility in Utica, New York, it's Riverside, I believe, or Riverview, that has their family-centered care so developed that you may want to contact them.
Great, thank you.
Again, please press star 1 to ask a question.
This is Kathleen. And Kathy, I'd like to ask you a question. How do you work with new staff, and how do you work with your staff in an ongoing way in terms of continuing to develop their awareness and their skills in your, you know, in the creativity and connection kind of world?
Oh, well, you know, it really by continual dialogue around how people conceptualize kids and their issues, making sure that, and on a busy unit, really making sure that those meetings where staff get together and come to a common understanding of a particular child, that those meeting times are kind of our sacred times, and that even if they can only be short ones, because again, inpatient units are busy, that those times happen. And then as you have those meetings, you want someone at those meetings to come in who has perhaps a little bit more knowledge of the current literature on current understandings of either the illness or the neurobiology of the illness, to be peppering in a more in-depth understanding so people can come to a different appreciation of what the child's going through. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like people that go into psychiatry have to love to talk and talk to each other. They have to love to think about what's going on at that moment with the child.
Mm-hmm.
I had someone who told me that when they applied for jobs, when they walked on units, they looked at what the staff were talking about in their spare time, and that when they went on units where staff were always talking about the kids and what they could do for the kids, they knew that was a good unit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you have to really engender that kind of curiosity about how can we think about kids and come to a common psychological understanding of what they're about.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I think we've come to the end of our question and answer session. Operator, am I right? We don't have anybody in the queue, right?
That's correct. There's no one in the queue at this time.
Okay. Again, I would like to very much thank both Dale Bluebird and Kathy Delaney for their, you know, incredibly insightful presentations. I think this is a conversation that obviously will need to continue. And I thank all of our participants. If you have information that you'd like to share about the conference, or if you'd like to be able to get in touch with each other in any way, please use me as a point of contact. My email is Kathleen, K-A-T-H-L-E-E-N, at NAPHS.org. And I'd be happy to, you know, to get people in touch with each other, or to, you know, help you find some of the resources that we've discussed today. So again, thank you very much. We appreciate your time, and have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the presentation. You may disconnect. Good day.